Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. We begin today's show by talking about the devastating wildfires in California. Since August 15th, 700 fires have charred more than 1.3 million acres. Joining us with the latest is Suzanne Rust, an investigative reporter for the LA Times, where she specializes in environmental issues. She was previously editor of Columbia University's Energy and Environmental Reporting Project, where she oversaw several projects, including a series that examined ExxonMobil's understanding of climate science in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. Hi, Suzanne. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks. Nice to hear from you.
Well, it's great to have you, Suzanne. Where are you right now? And I'm just wondering how your air quality is.
So I'm in San Rafael right now. The air quality is actually okay. It was okay. There was a marine sort of layer hanging over the city when I first got here. It's beginning to lift, and it's clear there's a little fog here or a little smoke here, just like there is throughout the rest of the Bay Area. It was masked behind the marine layer recently.
Right. It's so interesting because in San Francisco, the air was so fresh yesterday, and I woke up this morning and I think it's the worst I've ever experienced. I've been hosting the show in my kitchen, but I had to move my equipment because the kitchen's just unbearable this morning. You know, Suzanne, this brings up a lot of issues, and we did a show last week about the health effects of air quality, and our guest said, if you can, do not go outside when the quality is bad, because we're learning so much about how the particles affect your immune system. And I just always think about the homeless, the mail carriers, the servers who are now working at restaurants that are outside. Have you done much reporting on, you know, specifically the homeless who are breathing in this air 24/7?
I have not, but I think it is really an area that needs to be looked into. I mean, as you point out, these people are outside. They're exposed to this. It's been, 2 weeks now with this constant exposure to what's considered really, really unhealthy air. And clearly, there needs to be a much closer examination of this issue.
Right. And at the very least, government officials need to hand out the best masks, but we still have a shortage. My mailman has a very thin mask on. He said he's having a hard time breathing. And the servers that I've seen are also wearing very thin masks.
Yeah. I mean, and it's the only masks that really work are these N95. The masks that everybody else is wearing, the ones made of cloth, whether they're thin or not, it doesn't help against this stuff. It's PM 2.5, this particulate matter that is of such concern.
Right.
So it's really a problem.
Well, you can find that show, really important information about what we now know about air quality and how it affects our immune systems. And children especially should not be breathing in this air. You can find it at yourcallradio.org, and then purpleair.com will give you up-to-date air quality monitoring. Let's talk about the latest with the fires, Suzanne. According to Cal Fire, the SCU lighting complex, this is the huge one in Santa Clara, Alameda, Contra Costa, San Joaquin, and Stanislaus. This has been 35% contained as of this morning. The other massive one, the LNU, Napa, Sonoma, Lake, Yolo, and Solano counties, that's contained 35%. What are you hearing from Cal Fire about these massive, massive fires?
Well, I think everybody is feeling, everybody's terrified, clearly, concerned. But I understand. I've been spending most of my time actually in the smallest of the three of them, the one up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, the CZU Lightning Complex. I was there yesterday. There are crews out everywhere. Cal Fire has deployed their OES strike teams. These are their Operation Emergency teams. So everywhere I went, I saw teams out. They're looking for spot fires. I think it's 27% contained or 26% contained in the CZU at this point. The weather has been conducive for firefighting. The winds have not been strong. It's been relatively cool. As I just explained in San Rafael, there was this marine layer this morning. People are finding dew on their porches. So all of this is really good in terms of firefighting. However, as we all know, this is the end of August, September. Temperatures still get really warm here in Northern California. Things are still going to get really dry. So I think everybody is feeling okay right now, but really concerned about what's coming. I know the temperature is supposed to rise today. It's supposed to dry out a bit. Winds are supposed to pick up. And at least up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, a lot of the fires are not just the result of the lightning, but the later wind blowing, debris around that's on fire. And so I was driving around yesterday. There's still smoldering patches that weren't there the day before because stuff is still moving around. And if it dries out and warms up, we could be looking at a really concerning situation again.
So you're monitoring the CZU fire. According to CAL FIRE, that one has been contained 26% as of this morning. Can you tell us more about what this means exactly? How do they know that it's been 26% contained?
So they now are able to get in and do some aerial surveys. They're able to see where the fire line is. They have an idea about where they have pushed the fire line back. So I can't say I know the algorithm they use, but they definitely have a general sense of how much they have contained the fire by where the fire line has moved back, and by the amount of fires and fires that they're seeing in aerial surveys. So I know that's where they get the information. Don't know exactly how they calculate it.
You had a very interesting article that ran just a couple days ago called In Bonnie Doon, A Ragtag Outfit Stays Behind to Save Their Homes. And you wrote about these 50 Bonnie Doon residents who stayed behind to save their homes, which, of course, the fire department says never do that. But these guys were desperate, and they actually succeeded, right?
Yeah, it's a really interesting situation up there. Bonnie Doon is not really a town. It's just sort of an incorporated area in Santa Cruz County. So they don't really have a fire department per se. There were reports coming out last week, at the end of last week, that CAL FIRE, because these fires are going on all around the Bay Area, were really, they were strapped. They didn't have the resources to get where they needed to be. And as these reports came out, people were evacuated, or got that evacuation orders, people were like, I'm not leaving my house, right? There's going to be nobody here to take care of it. The CAL FIRE is all over the place. They're trying to put down fires everywhere. They're not coming here. So people stayed behind. One of the things that the people who live up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and this is a generality, but many of the people who live up there are firefighters. They're emergency responders. They're foresters. They take down trees. This is what they do for a living, right? It's managing land. They live up there. They don't have gas lines to their house. They don't have water pumps, right? They don't necessarily live off the grid, but it's about as close as you can. It's a really self-sufficient population up there. And the idea of just leaving their house to let it burn was not sitting well. So a lot of people did stay behind. And reports I've heard from people who have stayed behind are, the fire really flared up, it sounds like, Tuesday night in areas, and it was frightening. But after that, it almost became this slow-moving fire. One guy described it to me as he could see the fire a mile from his house over the ridge. It took 2 days for that fire to get to him. That's just 1 mile, and it just traveled that slowly. All he had to do was sort of dig a trench around his house, and the fire stopped. So for many of the people up there, they're talking about sort of the manageability of the fire posed, and sort of the non-threat it was posing to them, so they stayed. On the other side, there are fire forces up there who are really concerned that things could get out of control and these people could be in danger's way. And while they're going around responding to fires in different places, if they come across somebody who's in there, they have to then put their resources toward that person and making sure they're okay rather than going out and putting out spot fires. So there's a real conflict up there right now between what is the right thing to do in terms of homes, in terms of property, in terms of safety. But you could see both sides are sort of desperate with the situation.
Right. Suzanne Rust is an investigative reporter with the LA Times specializing in environmental issues, and she has been covering the fires in Santa Cruz. And if you have any questions for Suzanne, she'll be with us for about 10 more minutes. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Suzanne, what can you tell us about resources? Because We've been doing shows about these devastating fires for years, and all of the experts have told us this is our new norm. When you factor in the climate crisis, the fires are just going to be more devastating. So in terms of the state funding and resources for Cal Fire, can you just tell us, give us some insights into what has really changed, given that we now have the information we need to know about the connection between these fires and the climate crisis?
Well, so all of this, I mean, yeah, so this information is out there, and Cal Fire has, you know, in the past few years had to respond to some of the largest fires in California history, right? And as the state gets more populated, these fires pose new problems and concerns. And so there is an understanding that more resources and funding need to go into this. This year was peculiar in a number of different ways. One, there was the coronavirus, and as a result of the coronavirus, there were concerns about prisons, right? You had these huge populations of people living in the same place, a disease that was highly contagious, people getting sick. So minor offenders have largely been kept away from prisons or released. Prisoners make up a significant number of firefighters. They are used as forces to go and, you know, do this. This is what I was talking about, creating these almost burn lines around houses. I'm not using the right word there, but through defense lines, they go and they use hand tools and they dig, and they aren't paid very much, but they're not paid at all, I don't think, but they're a huge people resourced force that has in years past helped to combat fires. They're not there this year, and so that manpower is non-existent. So it sort of left Cal Fire in a place where they just didn't have the number of people and crews to go out and do this sort of basic defense work. The other thing that happened, as I know you've already talked about on the show last week, it's this everybody predicted it, right? But sometimes you predict it and you don't realize it's happening until it's actually happened. Suddenly, in mid to late August, there was practically a tropical storm that ran through the Bay Area. It was humid. There was lightning. I mean, everybody sort of felt that storm, and it was so unusual. But as a result of that, all around the Bay Area, not just one discrete patch, but north, east, south, right, even west on the mountains, things just went up in flames. And again, in these populated areas, and Cal Fire just, they were completely unprepared for this. They have since, you know, battened things up. They've got people from all over the state, from out of state. There are reports even from Australian fighters coming in. They're getting there, but the initial response was, I think everybody was taken by surprise. Even as you say, none of us should have been taken by surprise. This stuff has been projected and predicted for years. So I'm not sure that's giving you much else insight into Cal Fire's planning, but other than to say it wasn't planned this time.
Right. And what else does Cal Fire need? Because this is an early fire season and it's just the beginning. This is going to last for about another 3 months. I mean, we hope that we're not going to see bigger fires, but we have to be ready for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think everybody is aware of that and everybody's concerned. One of the stories I worked on last week was a story about a operation rescue center, or they work with FEMA. It's the Menlo Park Fire Protection District. They have a FEMA strike force, and they, for the past 20 years, have been called out to things like Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Irma, Harvey. They go around the country when they are needed to come and do disaster and survival relief. They went up into the mountains last week when, you know, several members of their force were living up in Boulder Creek or Ben Lomond and didn't have the resources they needed to fight these fires. So FEMA unofficially sent these crews up. They are not going to be what they are talking about right now. There are several of these California strike forces. They're not going to be able to go around to different places in the country, right? We're getting the east side of the country, the Gulf is getting hit by hurricanes right now. These strike teams would normally go there, but they're staying put because everybody is ready for things to continue for the next few months. So I think we're just going to see almost a reshuffling of how these strike forces in the country are deployed over the next 2 months to be here, anticipating that we're going to have a rough time. And one of the things we haven't even talked about yet, but once the fire season is over, you go to these mountains, there's no ground cover. The trees, the redwoods are still standing, but you can actually hear them falling as you walk through the mountains. Mm. But trees are dead. As soon as the rains start, there's real concern about massive mudslides coming. So I think we're looking at a precarious fall and winter.
Mm. Wow. Look, Greg just wrote, and he wanted to know what fraction of firefighters are prisoners. And the LA Times did have an editorial back in November. And according to this piece, it's called Inmates Risking Their Lives Deserve a Chance at Full-Time Jobs. California has 3,700 inmates working at minimum security training facilities called fire camps throughout the state. 2,600 are qualified to fight the fires. They make $2 to $5 a day plus a dollar per hour when they're on a fire.
I'm afraid I don't know the percentage, but I do know it's a significant number of the force. They're not paid well. I had one person describe it to me as a chain gang, right? That Cal Fire has overseers, and they send these people out, and you know they do hard labor, digging out trees, cutting down trees, digging down brush, and they're paid a minimal amount. The other thing is once my understanding is once they are out of prison, they do not qualify then to join the fire departments around them because of their prison background. So it's a tragic situation where people become, they fight these fires, they have the skills to do it, and then they can't leave prison with these skills and then get hired to help communities. The other thing to mention here is in these communities, again, up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, like the Ben Lomond Fire Department, the Boulder Creek Fire Department, these are all volunteer fire forces. And they are paid $12 per incident. So at the end of this time that they have all put in, starting last Monday and Tuesday, who knows how long this will be dragging along, they will get paid $12 for all of that time.
Well, according to Mother Jones, 30 to 40% of California's firefighters are prisoners. And we should just do a show about this in the coming weeks. Thank you for the question, Greg. I also wanted to ask you, Suzanne, about help from the federal government. Miles Taylor is Donald Trump's former chief of staff at the Department of Homeland Security. He is speaking out now against Donald Trump. One of the claims he makes is that Trump told FEMA to no longer give money to people whose homes burned down in California because he, quote, was so rageful that people in the state of California didn't support him and that politically it wasn't a base for him. Have you heard about this?
Yeah. So I think it was right after the campfire up in and the Woolsey fire, that terrible year, I believe it was 2018, Trump was saying at the time, made an announcement that he wasn't going to send any more money to California if they didn't clean up their act. And we submitted FOIAs at the time. We're of course still waiting for those. But that was our understanding as well, that this was all motivated by his dislike for California because they had not supported him in his presidential run and were giving him a hard time about a variety of things. So, that hasn't happened. They're still getting funding, but clearly he was directing his deputies not to give money to the state, which is a concerning situation, clearly, considering this is the most populous state in the union and people are killed by fires.
Right. Well, Suzanne, once you get that information, we would love to have you back.
Yeah, me too. I'd love to get that information.
Yeah, I bet. Well, Suzanne, thank you for all of your reporting, and stay safe, and we'll have you back in the near future.
All right, thank you. It was nice talking with you.
Thank you. You too. Suzanne Rust is an investigative reporter for the LA Times, specializing in environmental issues, and she's been closely covering the fires near Santa Cruz. You can find her reporting at yourcallradio.org. And again, just a reminder that so many experts say if you can, if it smells outside, try to stay inside as much as possible, because it really does have effects on our immune system, especially children. And you can find that show at yourcallradio.org. Now we are going to talk about the police shooting of Jacob Blake, a 29-year-old black father in Kenosha, Wisconsin. We're also going to talk about this week's Republican National Convention. Now I would like to welcome Joshua Holland to the show. Joshua is a contributor to The Nation and host of Politics and Reality Radio. Joshua, it's been a while. Nice to have you back.
Nice to be here, Rose. Thanks for having me. By the way, the new podcast is called We've Got Issues.
Ah, I like the title. Thank you for that. We've got issues. Wow, we definitely do. And we're also joined by Will Bunch, an award-winning journalist and national columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. He's also author of the political blog and newsletter Attitude. Hi, Will. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Will. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, great to have both of you. I want to start off by talking about Jacob Blake. We did a show about what happened in Kenosha with a reporter on the ground yesterday. Jacob is a 29-year-old black father. He was shot in the back 7 times. His family says he's paralyzed from the waist down. We're going to play a clip from his dad in just a couple of minutes. We also did a show. We also focused on the 17-year-old who was arrested for allegedly shooting 2 people at a protest, killing 2. Joshua, I feel like, are we becoming numb to this? Because this is a young 17-year-old with an automatic rifle who killed 2 people on the streets. And yet the Republican convention just went on as if it didn't happen.
Well, I think it's much worse than us becoming numb to it. I think we've normalized the idea that violence in defense of private property is acceptable. And I think that it's been a very disturbing and troubling few years, and I find the conservatives rallying around this kid who took an assault rifle to another community and allegedly murdered 2 people, wounded a third, is maybe the most troubling thing that I've experienced in the last few years. They claim that he acted in self-defense. They're basing that on the fact that after he had killed somebody, several of the protesters, including one who was then subsequently killed, tried to disarm him. And, there was an FBI study of mass shooting incidents, a significant share of which end when somebody who is not armed tackled the shooter. This is not, this is something that you should, if you have no other option, you should attempt to tackle a shooter in a circumstance like that. They caution that you should, of course, take cover, and that's your first possibility. But in any event, we had the Republican National Convention, in which they featured and celebrated the McCloskeys, this couple who trained their weapons on a group of peaceful protesters, and they justified that because those protesters were in a private community. And, 2 days later, this horrific incident happens, and he is now being hailed as a hero in certain circles on the conservative side, and it's extremely disturbing.
Yeah. What would you add, Will?
Well, I thought it was interesting at the outset when you said we're going to talk about the Jacob Blake shooting in the aftermath, and we're going to talk about the Republican convention, because normally those would be 2 things that would be so separate from each other than possibly a thoughtful condemnation of the violence in Wisconsin. But instead they're very closely related, as Joshua just alluded to, because you had the McCloskeys, this couple who were celebrated as heroes, and you had this message at the RNC that that Donald Trump is the bodyguard of Western civilization, that we need to defend the suburbs, and people like this impressionable 17-year-old kid, who've grown up on Facebook, basically, in this kind of world of make-believe and this very politicized world of half-truths, you know, they answered this call. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about the Republican Party sending out dog whistles to its voters about, you know, racial issues, you know, coded things that only voters can receive. These aren't dog whistles. This was this RNC was sending out a bat signal basically in the sky, you know, for people like this kid, for people like vigilantes to come out and defend the suburbs, you know, which basically is coded language for defending white supremacy, basically. And so, I have to say this has just been one of the most disturbing weeks in American history that I've lived through because of incidents like this one.
And Joshua mentioned that conservatives are hailing the young shooter as a hero. And just to give you some specifics, Jamel Bowie has a column in the New York Times called Kenosha Tells Us More About Where the Right is Headed Than the RNC Did. Ann Coulter said that Kyle Rittenhouse is, quote, my president. Graham Allen, a contributor to Charlie Kirk's Turning Point USA, Charlie Kirk spoke at the RNC, called the Kenosha killings a, quote, justified shooting. Katie Pavlich, a Fox host, said, when you have no police around to defend businesses and people who are being attacked, then there is a void that is filled. It just goes on and on. And we will put this link up if you'd like to read it at yourcallradio.org. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're joined by Will Bunch, an award-winning journalist, national columnist for the Philadelphia News. Daily News. Joshua Holland is a contributor to The Nation and host of We've Got Issues. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're joined today by Joshua Holland, contributor to The Nation and host of We've Got Issues. Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist and national columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. I also want to talk about why we are here in the first place. I mean, Trump has been talking about violence in the suburbs and just violence. And, you know, the media, many media are repeating what he says. And well, why are people marching and angry and calling for justice in the first place? So I want to play a clip from Jacob Blake Sr. Again, we're still waiting on details about what exactly happened before Jacob Blake walked back to his car. But we do know, we saw in video, when he walked back to his car, his three kids were inside, he was shot 7 times by police. This is Jacob Blake Sr. speaking with CNN.
When I got to his side, he grabbed my hands and began to weep. And he told me he thought he was hallucinating. And then he said, I love you, Daddy. Daddy, I love you.
Yeah, it must be so hard to see him in this condition.
Yes. Then his next question was, why did they shoot me so many times? And I said, baby, they weren't supposed to shoot you at all.
I mean, of course, you don't have an answer to that. And none of us have been given an answer to that. And I mean,
we spread a lot of love in there. And he knows where I live. And he just said, I didn't think you were going to be able to come. And I just reassured him, I'm not leaving.
And he didn't think you would be able to come because you live in a different state?
Yeah. And there's so many things that bothered me. But when I walked into that room, you know, he's paralyzed from the waist down. Why do they have that cold steel on my son's ankle? He can't get up. He couldn't get up if he wanted to. So what was that's a little overkill. To have him shackled to the bed, that just makes no sense to me. His main concern when we were talking was his sons. He was, in his mind, he just wanted to get, his sons out of harm's way. But before he could get them out of the car, he said he was just counting shots. He said he was counting them. And I guess he lost consciousness. around number 4 or 5. The oldest in the car was 8, and the youngest in the car was 3.
And have you talked to them?
Oh, they're with me every day.
What do they say? What? How are they coping with this morning?
The oldest, every day his question is, Daddy, why did the police, they call me Papa. And all my grandkids call me Papa or Pop-Pop. So he said, Papa, why did they shoot my daddy in the back? Where's daddy? They want their father because he was a part of their life every day. He's a person. He's a human being. He's not an animal. He's a human. But my son has not been afforded the rights of a human. He's not been treated like a human. He's a father. He's not a deadbeat dad. He's a father that's with his children every day.
That is Jacob Blake Sr. talking to CNN about his son. Joshua, I thought it was important to play this clip because, first of all, it's so sad that a father has to feel that he needs to tell the world that his son is not a deadbeat dad and he's not an animal. But to learn that Jacob Blake is paralyzed from the waist down and his ankle is shackled to the hospital bed, I mean, that's just horrific.
Yeah, and police have not announced any charges that they brought against him. So it's a horrific incident. It's obviously not the first horrific incident, even in recent months. So the lack of acknowledgement that protests are happening for a very sound and important reason is important. It's distorting our discourse about this, and. You know, there's a lot that's missing from, in my opinion, missing from a lot of the mainstream analysis, the mainstream reporting on this. One is the role of policing in causing a peaceful protest to become violent. In incident after incident, and I saw this firsthand in Oakland when I was covering Occupy years ago. What we've seen is an overwhelmingly peaceful protest and then seemingly arbitrary, belligerent policing causing people to lash out. And that's a big piece that's missing from this. The other piece that's missing, I think, is, and this is a problem where, you know, the traditions of publishing and Trump's rhetoric are aligning, which is, if it bleeds, it leads. We know this. It's a cliche. Municipal papers love stories about surges in crime, et cetera, et cetera. Trump and the Republican Party is basically using a big lie here that American cities are in chaos, that they're burning down, that there's widespread looting, there's widespread rioting, crime is going out of control. Rudy Giuliani last night said that crime had been increasing by numbers that you couldn't even believe. Now, if you go to the actual New York Police Department crime statistics, what you see is that there were 560 fewer serious crimes in July of 2020 than there were in July of 2019. If you go to Portland, what you'll see is that all of the chaotic images that are so popular on social media that Fox plays again and again and again on a loop are literally confined to a 6-block area around the federal courthouse. It was true in Seattle, where you had a small occupation, whatever you want to call it, limited in geographic scope. There's nothing going on in these cities except for the fallout from the pandemic and the economic chaos, but they've chosen this as a strategy based on, you know, Nixon's 1968 campaign, a very different campaign, a very different set of circumstances, and they're pushing this rhetoric, and it is causing people like that young shooter to believe that there is mayhem that they have to go encounter. It's an extremely dangerous situation.
Will, what would you add? Can you hear us now, Will?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, okay. I couldn't hear Mr. Blake Sr.'s audio clip, unfortunately, but I can hear the show. So, I mean, I wouldn't add a lot. I think again, Joshua, kind of nailed it in that. And it's interesting because you can see going all the way back to 2016 that Donald Trump has consciously modeled his politics in some way after Richard Nixon. And, you know, the idea that the way that he can unify a almost all-white electoral base behind him is to portray himself as this law and order candidate, you know, as the guy that I alone can fix it, you know. And, I mean, it's ironic because now he's been president for 3.5 years, and, what has he fixed exactly? So, but yeah, I mean, you're seeing this mayhem in a small area in Portland and in a tiny area of Seattle and other cities, getting amplified way out of proportion. And in fact, you know, when Trump sent Department of Homeland Security officers into Portland, several weeks ago, and they were going out at night, snatching people into vans. I mean, they were basically trying to create more disorder. They weren't trying to prevent disorder. They were trying to, they were basically trying to create scenes for Fox News, because whenever you watch the, you know, 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock nightly shows on Fox, the first 5 minutes is this loop of people burning things down, people throwing bottles at police officers. You know, it doesn't matter if it happened 3 months ago. It doesn't matter if it happened in Spain and they just borrowed the clip or whatever. But they're determined to give their viewers the impression that this is just happening all the time. And now they're trying to twist these really tragic events in Kenosha. They're trying to twist these events to fit their narrative.
What about the media's role here? And I hope you can hear me well. I just had to put my mask on because the smoke is just getting worse, it feels like, by the minute. Dan Frumkin.
Another thing they didn't talk about at the Republican convention, by the way,
sure.
Right? The California wildfire.
Oh, no. No, exactly. And it's just really brutal right now. Frumkin with PressWatchers.org, he linked to a piece in the Washington Post called U.S. Political Divide Becomes Increasingly Violent, Rattling Activists and Police. And Dan writes, the both-sidist coverage of overwhelmingly right-wing political violence needs to stop. Josh, what are your thoughts on that?
I could not possibly agree more. If you look at the amount of political violence that has occurred, it has been disproportionately directed against protesters by police, by these Boogaloo Boys, these far-right extremists, by Proud Boys, and depicting it as a both-sides thing it requires conflating different things. Last night, Senator Rand Paul claimed that he was attacked when protesters heckled him. Nobody laid a finger on him. He was surrounded by police the whole time. He was never in danger. He's requesting the FBI to make arrests. He claims that they were outside agitators. You know, this is the kind of thing that the instinct to find similarities between both sides is hardwired into a lot of reporters' minds, and it is a convention, and it's very destructive. And I would add to that, you know, look at all the attention paid to Antifa. You know, Antifa activists, I mean, we're all anti-fascists in the broader sense, but Antifa activists, the people who identify as such, are a very small group. There's probably fewer than 1,000 of them in the United States. Much of what they do is behind a computer screen. The most Antifa activism is doxing members of extremist groups. and attaching social and reputational professional consequences to membership in those groups. You would never know that from reading the condemnations of Antifa, even from, you know, so-called liberal pundits.
And I also want to just quickly go back to the shooter, because this is really important. We talked about this a bit yesterday, but we did see the National Guard handing out water bottles to these self-described militias. We see tape of the 17-year-old walking toward the police cars. Milwaukee Sentinel Sheriff David Beth's deputies, according to reports, fraternized with white supremacist counter-protesters and allowed the shooter to leave as people yelled that he was the shooter. The sheriff excused this by saying his deputies may not have paid attention to the gunman because there were many distractions, including screaming and hollering, people running, police vehicles idling, traffic, for example. Will, what about this? I'm still waiting for reporters to really ask these officials, why are you handing out bottled water to these guys dressed in military garb holding assault rifles? Are you working hand in hand with them? I mean, what is going on here? Yesterday, The Guardian
It looks that way, doesn't it? I mean, and the thing is, I mean, we've seen the video. It was certainly a chaotic situation Tuesday night when that occurred. However, how do you explain the fact that this happens again and again and again? It wasn't a one-time mistake, you know? Why are armed protesters allowed to overrun the Michigan state legislature, for example? I mean these Boogaloo boys, we have these open carry laws in many states in the United States, which are just interpreted in kind of extreme, ridiculous ways. So basically, it's perfectly normal for a person to walk down the middle of the street with an AK-47 type assault rifle or an AR-15 or whatever this kid had, but clearly we all know that the police are making decisions on these things based on other factors like race or political affinity. How else can you explain why the exact same officers in Kenosha would fire 7 shots into a man who they, later claimed, and we don't know all the evidence, maybe was trying to retrieve a knife in his car, but we don't even, there was no way of really even knowing that at the time, and they shot this man 7 times, and these same officers, responding to a shooting, let this guy carrying a long gun with his hands up in the air, which is basically acknowledgement saying, hey, I did it, and he still walks right past them and then ends up driving home and is never arrested. I mean, that doesn't happen unless there's like extreme structural bias and, structural racism within these institutions like the police department.
And if you want to read more about this, the New York Times has a visual investigation called Tracking the Suspect in the Fatal Kenosha Shooting. We're also going to do another show about the connection between white supremacists and militias in police forces. There's a new Guardian piece up. A former FBI agent, Michael German, has written extensively about this. And I mean, when Jordan Davis was shot and killed in 2012 in Florida by a white man in a gas station parking lot, and we've had his dad on many times. Back in 2012, his dad was talking about this. So we're going to do a show about this. I want to ask you both about how the media are really focusing or not focusing enough on just blatant racism. NPR had a really interesting story this morning about how 50 activists walked from Milwaukee, Wisconsin to Washington, D.C. This morning, there was a rally on the mall in D.C. to commemorate the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, August 28th, 1963, where MLK spoke. Taryn Powell from WUWM reports that along the way, marchers said they were called the N-word. They had food thrown at them. They said when they chanted Black Lives Matter, onlookers said Trump 2020. They also said they were shot at. So, Josh, what about just the blatant racism and the attacks that have gone up under Trump? How do you think the media are or are not reporting on this?
Well, I mean, there have been certainly reports. There was a database put together that found 150 incidents of racialized abuse or assaults in which the perpetrator specifically cited Trump's name in the first, I think it was over the first 18 months of his presidency. It is a constant, but, you know, one of the things is that you have, one of the things that makes it difficult to discuss these things is that you have people shouting the N-word at people. You have people giving Nazi salutes at Blue Lives Matter protests. You have explicit racism. But the thing that's causing people to get killed is implicit bias. Implicit racial bias, and that I think is something that is difficult to report and is difficult to write about, in the sense that, you know, if somebody is screaming the N-word, that's obvious and you can tell a story about the circumstances surrounding that. There was an incident last week in Baton Rouge where a guy was panhandling in a parking lot of a store, and this 24-year-old white kid was offended and yelled at him to leave people alone, and then he went to his car and he retrieved a gun and he went and shot the man. And he first shot the man, attempted to shoot the man, and his gun jammed, and he re-racked it to put another round in the chamber and then shot him. The police came, they filled out a report. They said that the victim was unarmed and out of arm's reach of the man who perpetrated the killing. And then they let him go. Wow. They let him go. They didn't charge him with a crime. This premeditated murder, clearly premeditated murder. Suspect was white. Victim was a black panhandler, and if that isn't the kind of clearest example of the way implicit bias plays out in these things, I don't know what is. They finally arrested the shooter after several days of community pressure, but the police officers on the scene did not think that this was worthy of an arrest.
Hmm. Wow. That is Josh Holland, contributor to The Nation. We'll find an article about that and put it on our website. Will, why don't we end by getting your thoughts, you know, taking this all back to the convention. I mean, you wrote a column called Trump Surreal, Shameful RNC Inflamed American Carnage and Ignored It. We don't have time to take, let's see here, Greg's call. But Greg says Trump neglecting the amount of people who are dying from COVID is criminal. We've got over 180,000 deaths. We might have about 200,000 by the election. What are your thoughts overall, Will? I mean, what I'm hearing, I haven't had much time to read the articles, but I'm just hearing in broadcast media, the reporters are basically repeating what Trump is saying. What are your thoughts about how the media have really covered this convention?
Yeah, I mean, to me, you know, I mean, what Trump is saying is definitely a lesser part of the story. I mean, you need to focus, first of all, on the way that he said it in terms of, you know, commandeering the White House, the People's House, and using all these other government resources for his political advantage, you know, capped with a fireworks show over the government and taxpayer-funded Washington Monument. You know, it was just really kind of a disgusting quasi-fascist, you know, show of authority, and I mean, to me, that kind of overshadowed anything he had to say. And then, in terms of what he did say, you know, what was most striking was just the incredible number of lies, you know, both about Joe Biden's policies and about you know, building up Trump as somebody who defeated the invisible enemy. I mean, related to your listener's email. You know, there was clearly a concerted effort to pretend that the coronavirus was over, that Trump had won, and, you know, we're in the celebratory mood now with fireworks, and people on the lawn were sitting in chairs literally 6 inches apart from each other, which was just stunning. Only, you know, a handful of people in this crowd of 1,000 or maybe even 2,000 people were wearing masks. So, you know, the whole thing is just a stunning display. And I think the focus just on Trump's speech, which, you know, he delivered in this weird monotone kind of sing-songy as if he was really looking at the words on the teleprompter for the very first time. You know, I think that level of journalism is a disservice to the reader because, you know, I think the words really mattered less than, you know, the kind of themes they were trying to set up with imagery and other things. And I mean, it was a very authoritarian setup. And if you care about democracy in this country, it was a very disturbing thing to watch.
Joshua, we've got about 30 seconds. What would you like to add?
You know, one of the things that I found kind of interesting that didn't get a lot of commentary was Melania's choice to wear a military outfit, given that her role in the convention was to project a softer, more moderate side of the Republican Party and to be more appealing to people beyond the base. And I thought that was a very interesting choice.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you both for joining us. Joshua Holland is a contributor to The Nation and host of We've Got Issues. Thank you, Joshua.
Thanks, Rose.
Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist and national columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. Thank you so much, Will.
Thanks, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I also want to mention The Guardian has a piece out. Over 1,000 U.S. health workers died of COVID. Many were immigrants and minorities. They wrote this with Kaiser Health News. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Damian Miner and Kevin Vance for keeping our studio going. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.